This is the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network.
Welcome back to Such Sights to Show, an all things Clive Barker podcast. I'm Joe Lipsett, and I'm joined as always by Mr. Brian Christopher. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Joe. We are at something of a momentous occasion today. We are reaching the end of an era.
It's like a milestone unlocked, achieved. I feel like we should have party balloons or some kind of decaying body dripping blood in a corner.
Yeah, this feels like hitting like 100% of a video game or something mm-hmm. like that, because there's just so much of the books of blood. The fact that we are coming to the sixth and final volume is pretty wild, actually.
It really, really is. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we knew that we were going to wrap it up because it seems like an obvious thing to do once you get started. And yet, it's a lot of books. Like, when you've read all six volumes, that's a lot of Barker.
Yeah, yeah, I would be interested to see what a consolidated page count would be on all six volumes.
Yeah, it's meaty.
And we've talked about how some of those stories are approaching novella length. These are never short stories. They all mm-hmm. have F to them.
Yeah, so it's interesting that we come to six and there's five stories. I would argue all of them are about the same length, but of course we're not going to talk about one of them because we've already talked about The Last Illusion when we did our discussion on that short story, as well as Lord of Illusions, the Clive Barker film. So technically we're only talking about four here, but I'm interested, Brian, what are your thoughts on this sixth and final volume?
It is hard to describe. Other than mm-hmm. the fact that I actually really enjoyed it. It was a very quick read. This was probably one of the quicker reads for me. I agree. Think these might have been a little on the shorter end of his short story length. But they were also, none of them were overly dense.
No.
Some of them were going into kind of different areas than what Barker does. It still mm-hmm. had the Barker flavor. But yeah, they were all solid. I enjoyed them all. I don't know that there were necessarily any standouts, but I did appreciate that it did seem like he was doing some different stuff on this final batch here.
Yeah, if folks have been listening along with us, which I imagine you probably are at this point, otherwise you're just a random person who's tracking down reviews of some of these volumes. But in our discussion of Volume 5, we talked about how it felt like Barker was starting to explore other genres a little bit more. It was less horrific than usual. It felt like we were dipping a toe into some fantasy territory, which of course we know Barker will do more of as he becomes a little bit more cemented as a writer. In the 90s, he really starts to go out into that realm. And I feel like this volume, Volume 6, continues that, albeit in different directions. Like, one of these is a full-up crime story with the usual Barker viscera involved.
Yeah, there's espionage in one of mm-hmm. these stories. It's wild. Yeah.
It is wild. Very unexpected.
None of it, though, is stuff where it's swing and a miss for me, where it's he tried something but didn't work. It all worked for me. I liked them all.
Yeah. I agree with you. I think that none of these are necessarily my favorites of the six volumes. And yes, folks, we are going to rank our favorites at the end of this episode. But I agree. I found this a fast read, an enjoyable read. All of the stories had at least a couple of elements that felt very Barker-y, which was nice. And I don't know. It seemed like a nice way to polish this off.
I agree. Yeah. I honestly couldn't think of a better way for him to wrap up. I 100% agree that it's not, there's nothing in here that seems like it is the absolute epitome of what Barker does. Mm-hmm. And none of these, I don't think any of these are going to be my favorites, but there is certainly nothing in here that anywhere approaches my least favorite either.
Right.
I think just him capping things off with, some stuff where he's branching out a little bit, I think was a really good idea. Especially with, you might think that, like, you know, if this is kind of the finale, he might be like, okay, I'm going to give him some, like, true Clive Barker bangers. But no, he's just kind of like, he's playing it more subtle here. And then there's also the, to what degree, like, I doubt that all of these came out in the order in which he wrote them. Like, I don't picture, and correct me if I'm wrong if you know otherwise, but, like, I don't know that he necessarily, like, wrote all these volumes chronologically. So I'd be interested to know to what degree, like, he had, like, this big pool of stories, and these were the ones that got batched together just at different times for different volumes. Yeah, like, the curation. You know, we talk a lot about curation on this show and the way it didn't work out so well on our last collection of short stories with Midian Unmade. And there have been some hits and misses with the way it's been curated here. I think some stories have suffered in terms of, like, the order that they came. But I think this was, it was just a really kind of nice, weird to say about Clive Barker, but, like, pleasant ending to his collection.
Yeah. I mean, it's a bit of a cheat, right? Because we can for sure say that the final story on Jerusalem Street is, or was, likely always intended to be the capper of the stories. So whichever stories would come, this one was always going to come last because it brings the collection full circle. So it's commenting back on Books of Blood, which of course was that opening story. And it's quite short, but also mostly memorable. Like, I think it's a good capper. But I guess we should go in order. So, Brian, what did you think of The Life of Death, which is the first short story?
Yeah, here we have, following a brush with cancer and a subsequent hysterectomy, a woman named Elaine becomes fascinated with a church that is being demolished. He had some good buildup with this. You know, I like the idea, because sometimes, you know, with Clive, he'll just get right into it. And just kind of come out swinging. Here he's really building a sense of, like, okay, where is he going with this? I feel like he is taking a little bit of a gamble by writing from the point of view of a woman in a story that is, conventional wisdom would say that you need to have lived as a woman going through this to be able to write this story. So I would be interested to see, like, to what degree, you know, if there are women who have read this story, and I guess particularly women who have had a hysterectomy, like, what if this rings true? What if this seems like it maybe, you know, veers from verisimilitude? But for me, it did set this sense of numbness. Like, it establishes this sense of just emptiness that not hit home in a way that it's like I could associate with it, or that I could, like, that it's something that's been my experience, but it was a very kind of visceral experience just to kind of see this woman who is just empty. You know, she is
I mean, she's quite literally hollowed out, right?
Yes. Yeah. And trying to find something that she can latch onto. And, you know, I think that might be, like, that one area where, you know, I think not nearly that extended, but I think we've all had those moments where we're just, like, in a despair where it's like, I need to find something to latch onto, because otherwise I can't take another step. And so, yeah, here it is, this church that's being demolished. She also strikes up, like, a bit of a friendship, maybe budding relationship with this eccentric guy named Kavanaugh.
Well, he's nefarious.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, even before he's revealed to be who he is, it's red flag central.
Yes, yeah. There is, you know, something going on, you know, underneath the surface on that. And you don't know, because it is Clive Barker, though, you don't know, is this going to be villainous, or is this just going to be maybe monstrous? And, you know, for Barker, those are two very different things.
True.
Which is funny, because here we'll find out it is much more villainous than it is monstrous. It's a much more mundane villainy than where you think it's going to go, which I think is a pretty good
inversion. So boring.
Yes. Yeah. And I love that.
Yeah. It works for the story.
Yeah. And so, yeah, we do find out that eventually this church, there is a crypt underneath that gets opened up, and there were people, from what I'm gathering, it was basically like the plague, and people were just kind of stuffed in there. And Elaine, like, in her fascination with these bodies, winds up coming in contact with one and basically becomes patient zero.
Yeah.
And watching the way that that gives her like this weird return to like a spark for life is very interesting to watch. I do like the idea, and this is where this inversion comes in that I really enjoyed, where you think he's the personification of death, and that's what Elaine thinks. And then she kind of figures out, like, no, this guy's just a run-of-the-mill serial killer. And, like, it's not something she realizes in fear. Like, even as she is dying, like, she's not scared. She's actually just disappointed that this guy's like, oh, he's just a guy that kills
people. He's nothing bigger, nothing better. Yeah. He's so average.
And like her only saving grace as she starts like kind of going into the afterlife is to realize like, well, I've made him into something more because now he is carrying what I had.
Right.
And so it basically like her spark for life kind of comes from the idea that like, it's all going to get burned down. So whatever. Like it's like she comes to a certain kind of peace with that. And it's a really weird. On one hand, it seems really nihilistic, but on the other hand, there's like a certain kind of like almost like Zen-like peace that comes with just realizing like it's all going to crumble.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said about Elaine as a female figure and whether or not Barker does an okay job, because I'll admit I never really considered it, you know, now that we're having the conversation and thinking about how we associate women's bodies with bringers of life, because you need to be able to have children, quote unquote, in order to like fulfill the female function. You know, this is the bullshit rhetoric that we give women or that we impose on them. So this idea that she is almost closer to death because she has had this hysterectomy and she can't perform her, you know, I'm using a lot of scare quotes right now. The traditional female function of bringing life into the world. But even before that, you know, you get this sense when she is recovering from her surgery and she goes into the office, no one in the office thinks that she's a vital, enjoyable person. Like she just seems to be almost a specter who's passing through life. She doesn't really impact their lives at all until she accidentally kills them all because she gives them the plague. And I thought that that was interesting how it almost reanimates her. This idea of this brush with death and then literally becoming the embodiment of it is what turns her into a living person that people start to take up and notice. And I thought that was interesting. I think it could have worked in another capacity. Like it has that extra meaning with the hysterectomy, but I just read her as a very fatalistic character, like somebody who had brushed up to the brink of death and then walked it back and had seen things that people who had not experienced that didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. And I do think with the hysterectomy element, I do think there is something to be said about the deliberate nature to which Barker incorporates the social element to that, because it's not that she is inherently worthless because she's had a hysterectomy. They hint at the pressure that's been put on her. Like her her ex, I believe his name is Simon or something like that. It's not super important to remember his name. But there's a nod to the idea that he's trying to kind of reconcile and get back with her. But, you know, she is remembering when she first let him know that, you know, she wouldn't be able to have kids anymore. He was like, well, you can't give me a son anymore. Like that was his reaction to it, not like, oh my god, this is so awful for you, what can I do. It was pointing out that like, you can't have my kid anymore, and that makes you, the implication is that you are less inherently valuable now.
And of course, once again, reminder folks that these volumes are coming out in the mid 80s, so even the way that we looked at sex and gender were different. It was definitely different. There was a large population of people who felt like, if I'm looking for a wife, it's because I want to have offspring. I want them to carry my child. So this idea that, you know, by not being able to do so does lessen Elaine's chances of being with somebody, or it might be a deterrent for a future partner, is realistic. I think it still applies nowadays, but particularly back in the 80s when it was like, no, I mean, if you're getting married, it's because you want to have kids, you want to move to the suburbs and blah, blah, blah.
Absolutely. So, yeah. And just, you know, I do think a mark in Barker's credit that, you know, he's having these discussions in the mid 80s and they're ones that are still to a degree applicable now.
I do want to circle back to what you said at the beginning, which is just how this story embodies a lot of things that we've come to expect from these Barker short stories. And the fact that I had no fucking idea where the story was going even probably into the last act of it, right? You know, we're introduced to this woman. She seems out of sorts and she meets this man and you're wondering, okay, where is this new relationship with Kavanaugh going to take her? And then all of a sudden we're exploring the church and we're getting a glimpse of who the people were that were entombed there and so on. The story just goes places. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that was very fun and sometimes challenging to keep up with Barker. And then when it ends, it almost becomes philosophical with the way that you describe how she's at peace with the fact that she's been murdered by this man. Mm-hmm. But it's because the whole experience has given her almost a religious epiphany.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree. Like, it was definitely something where I didn't realize that we were basically watching a plague story, but then in hindsight, it's like, oh yeah, that's where that
it's
was going.
It's so obvious,
like,
right?
Yeah. And which I think is the mark of a good story. Like, when you're in it, you're like, what are you doing here? And then, like, when you see how it pans out, it's like, oh yeah, of course that's where it was going. Yeah, that makes perfect mm-hmm. sense. You know, if we were looking back, like, well, I still don't see how you got from A to B, that would be a problem. But yeah, right. The fact that we were able to get to that ending and then see, like, oh, that's, yeah. I see the whole picture now, and I saw how you got there.
Mm-hmm. And then there's this nice transition between the life of death, this first story with this, you know, entombed civilization that gets discovered. And then we move into the second story, How Spoilers Bleed. And it's basically a story that advises, hey, colonizers, be careful what you wish for. I would argue this one's quite a bit more straightforward. It's about a group of white men who go to South America so that they can exploit it for its natural resources. And they encounter an indigenous group and they end up killing a boy and then an elder. And they basically just get a really horrific body horror curse put on them. And the idea is, once you've got this curse, it does not matter where you go or what you do. You are just basically going to liquefy.
Yeah. And it, so this is one of those stories, because I've talked in previous episodes about how I usually don't like stories that follow, like, unlikable characters, like usually mm-hmm. like unlikable white men. But these guys, ooh. I think it's the combination of how over the top, mustache twirlingly awful they were.
They're so caricaturish, right?
Along with how awful their comeuppance is. It was mm-hmm. just like, okay, this is like, while also still kind of having it's still a pretty dark ending, because in the end,
oh yeah,
like, they wipe out this whole village, you know?
Yep.
So this is not a happy ending by any mm-mm. means, but there is something about they at least get theirs in a way that is just so disgusting and horrifying. Like, the way he describes, and so the way ooh. This curse plays out, and it seems to play out slightly differently for each guy, but like, so the first guy is basically anything he touches, just the slightest amount of pressure is enough to open up a wound on his skin.
Yes. Ooh. Ooh.
Which, oh, because then it's like, and it just snowballs, because as he gets more and more freaked out, he runs mm-hmm. into more stuff and more wounds open. And yeah. I think by the end of it, they described him as kind of just looking like a big, like, blood clot. Or yeah. something along those lines.
It's fascinating, because you think, oh, okay, well, that's simple. He just has to isolate himself in a padded room and he would be fine. Literally what happens, he goes into mm-hmm. a safety room in a hospital, but he can't even, you know, put a finger to a glass because it will open up a fissure in the finger, in his palm, whatever. So, like, this man quite literally cannot touch anything without mm-hmm. opening fresh wounds, and that's not sustainable. Like, he would have to put his head down to sleep at some point yeah. and that would just split his head open. It is gnarly to think about the implications of this.
Yeah. No. And then, you know, the slight twist on the other guy that gets killed is that any minute particles in the air are enough to tear, like, a new mm-hmm. wound open. So he tries yeah. to, like, lock himself in this sterilized hospital room, but the other guy, because of course these are, like, shitty mercenaries and they're starting to turn on each other, he bursts into the door and that just mm-hmm. brings all of these dust particles in, and it just tears him to pieces. Not to pieces, but it tears him apart. And it's so awful, but it's also happening to the worst people. So you're just mm-hmm. like, good, enjoy. You yep. brought this on yourselves.
Yeah. The interesting thing about How Spoilers Bleed is that there are no surprises, like how the men are done away, as you said, the symptoms or the slight minute differences that they experience this curse. That's what makes it novel. But from the opening pages, you know, we're seeing these white men in an indigenous community. You know, they're awful, awful men. And you know it's going to end badly. Like, you can already tell that they're probably going to shoot one, if not multiple members of this community, and then it's going to come back on them. So I like that this story was so straightforward. There weren't those kinds of, ooh, where is he going to take us next? Mm-hmm. And instead, we just got to revel in watching these men get their comeuppance. And that was where the satisfaction lies.
Yeah, like, you know this train is coming. Like, mm-hmm. And they start off the story with, like, you know, the way they frame it, like, it's already happened to one of them. So, this is ending badly for them. I do think it's interesting the way he does inhabit the mercenaries to give them some sense of, like, what's going through their mind. And it's, mm-hmm. you know, especially with Locke, it's interesting the way he had it, like, well, I'm not as, like, savage as this these other guys. But meanwhile, he's like, you know, he goes into town and can only get off with a sex worker by just doing, like, the most depraved, degrading stuff that he can think of. And it's just, it is interesting the way Barker writes the lack of self-awareness that white men have. Because we will often rationalize our shitty behavior by saying, well, I'm not doing this. You know, I'm not as bad as this guy.
Yeah. And of course, we've seen this before, even as recently as the last volume when we were talking about the Madonna with the guy who tries to recruit the rich financier to redevelop the waterlogged building. And both of those men were absolutely terrible, but one tried to frame himself as better than the other one, even though he was beating his girlfriend. And you're just like, the delusion of these white male characters. Barker is frighteningly good at capturing it.
And it's one of those things that's like, okay, to what degree are you doing this from observation or from experience?
Oh,
maybe a little.
Wow, Brian. This is how we get canceled. It's a cease and desist from Clive Barker's estate.
That is a general statement about white men, not necessarily Barker. Did I backpedal enough?
Yeah, you know what? We'll wait and see whether we get served.
I will. I do feel like I need to, like, clarify in that. I am not saying I know anything about Barker that would indicate that, like, that's what he's doing, but just, like, white men are going to white men sometimes, and I say that as a white man. Like, so, you know, it's completely feasible to think that, like, those kinds of rationales has gone through Barker's brain at some point, because I'd be lying if I said they didn't go through mine.
Sure. Yeah. It's also hard to read so many of these stories. You know, we've read six of these volumes over the last year, so we're also picking up on recurring character traits or narrative beats and so on. And I think it's a strength of Barker's writing. I'm not going to hypothesize whether that's because he has a personal experience. I don't know. But he does have a really good finger on how white men are going to react to certain things. And it's often shitty.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Very much so.
So speaking of, that brings us to the third story, which is Twilight at the Towers. This is the super out of left field espionage story where we're dealing with UK spies who are trying to bring a Russian spy in from the cold. And it's a bunch of double crosses. And I don't know how you felt about this one, but in the first third of the story, I just thought, I feel like I'm reading a John le Carre novel. You know, it feels so out of place. And then all of a sudden, people start transforming.
Which, there was kind of a lot of twists and turns in terms of how I was approaching this as a Barker story. Because, initially it's like, this is not Barker at all.
No.
And then when he brings in the monstrous element, like, okay, this is Barker. And B, I am so scared as to where this is going to go, because I feel like the last time that we had a story where, like, someone was, like, altered in a lab, you know, that's where we get the Age of Desire, which is just so hard to read. Like, it was so good, but so hard to read, because there's just the level of, like sexual violence and depravity that happens in that story. I'm like, okay, well, here it comes. So mm-hmm. then to find out that it's werewolves was almost kind of quaint.
Yeah.
As a Barker story goes.
But the funniest thing is that it's very obviously werewolves, but we're never saying the word werewolf, mm-hmm. you know, and because it's infused with this spy drama, it's all trench coats and subterfuge. And I mean, this one to me felt the most period piecey. Sometimes I forget that these stories were written back in the mid 80s or probably even earlier before they were published. But this one felt very, oh, we're in the middle of the cold fucking war and we have, you know, these two opposing sides and who can you trust and so on. And then you quite literally throw a game of werewolf into the mix. And I thought that that was just so fun. This one, yeah. This one was the unexpected story of the bunch for me.
I agree. Yeah, I do. I admit I was it was a little spoiled for me because I started putting together the synopses for these and I was using Wikipedia for help. And I figured, like, if I just read the first like line or so, I'll get the general gist. And this was like I had read the first two. I hadn't finished this one. And then I saw like werewolves. I'm like, ah, shit.
Damn it.
Yeah. But it was still fun to see the way it played out, you know, and kind of taking the beats of that espionage thriller, you know, having that moment where like he's at this meetup location and it's, you know, do I need to worry about getting jumped? Am I going to get executed? And then it's like, ah, fuck it, throw a werewolf in there. Like, I love that.
Well, and the other interesting thing is that it's not, ooh, Ballard is following this man. Like he's the UK agent, Ballard, and he's basically been hired to look into Mironenko, who is the Russian spy that they're trying to get to turn on
Mironenko,
his own
maybe?
Team. Mironenko? Yeah, you know what? That
Mironenko?
Sounds right.
Yeah. That sounds Russian to me, so.
Right. So he's been hired to look into Mironenko, and he does so, and I think it's just a regular spy thing. It's espionage, and we're going to turn on each other, and who can we trust at the safe house, and so on. But we also know that he saw something weird in the streets, and we know it's some kind of beast. It's just a question of what. And when you realize it's werewolves, you think, oh, Ballard is going to either have to save the day or he's going to get bitten and he'll start to turn. It's all going to be very conventional werewolf drama. And I love the reveal, which happens probably just over halfway through the story, which is that Mironenko tells Ballard, oh, hey, no, you're actually just like me. We were both bred to be werewolves. You don't need a bite because, baby, you already are one and you just don't realize it yet.
Yeah. Yeah. They're almost like they are inherently sleeper agents. Like werewolves are kind of like the ultimate sleeper agent because you know, their trigger is the full moon.
Yeah, it's so silly. And then, of course, you know, the story, I would argue, ends on almost a comedic beat where Ballard ends up escaping and he just joins up with a pack of wolves or another pack of werewolves who have just been hanging out, watching the drama unfold, or they've been waiting for other people to come along. And you think, this started as one thing and it's ending as something completely different, and it feels weirdly seamless.
And also just like an unexpected or a rare, just kind of full-on happy ending, I feel like, for a Clive Barker story. Like,
yeah, you found
your
people.
He's a werewolf and he found his people.
Yeah, it's basically, it's a Nightbreed story to me, if we're being honest.
I agree. Without even the catch of the werewolves aren't necessarily like cast into a diaspora by the end of this one. Like they're finding each other.
Yeah, like they're fully just hanging out in London.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love that.
Okay, so next up would be The Last Illusion. We'll skip over that one and we'll go to the postscript story. So this one's quite a bit briefer than the other ones, On Jerusalem Street. And this one comes back around where we're looking for the Book of Blood, which is, of course, how we opened everything.
I'm actually wondering, like, I feel like you've probably read even more anthology stories than I have.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of, I know movies use, you know, framing stories quite a bit where, right, you know, they'll open and close with something on the same subject. I feel like I don't see this much when it comes to books.
No, I'll confess, a lot of the times when I'm reading anthologies, it is more of the Midian Unmade, where we have an editor do a kind of prologue or an introductory piece that outlines how everything's going to fit together. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the time, it's multiple different authors who were given an assignment. So I'm not actually used to reading a single short story collection. Like, I've read Stephen King's Ford of Midnight and Skeleton Crew and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. He doesn't do this kind of stuff. He doesn't use framing devices more often than not.
I do wonder if this is a little bit of, like, Clive Barker always seems to have that slight pull towards the cinematic. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if that's just kind of that sensibility coming through. And I'd also be interested to know, had he always written all of these with the framing stories already in mind, or was he coming to the end of these volumes and realized, mm-hmm, this would be a fun way to cap it off? Let's go back to the Book of Blood.
Yeah, if anything, because from what I remember, and I'm not going to lie, it's been a very long time since I've had to think about the Book of Blood. We started this project a while back, Brian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a bit.
I couldn't remember how that story ended. I remember it feeling like it wasn't an open ending, though, where it was inviting another story. I knew this story existed because I have seen the movie adaptation, which embodies both the first and this story. So I knew that there was more to come. But from what I remember, that first story didn't end on some kind of cliffhanger or ambiguous note where we said, oh, well, there's so much more story to come. Like, it felt like it had a nice little resolution where we learned what was embodied with the Book of Blood and how horrendous it would be to have all of these stories imprinted and written all over your body on every spare inch of skin. And that was satisfying. And then you come to this and you think, oh, this is like a fun little extra bit. Like, hey, we're going to go back to it and just give you a little taste or more. And that's how we're going to end the whole collection.
Yeah. And the more I think about it, because, yeah, that first one really does just seem like a really great meta introduction to these stories, as if, mm-hmm, you know, we are reading the storybooks of Blood by reading these stories. Like, these were the stories found on this guy's skin.
Yes.
And honestly, that make the way that kind of comes out seems like it's kind of its own entity. Mm-hmm. If I had to guess, I would say this was more of a, not an afterthought, but like a bonus that Barker decided to put together as he was getting to the end of compiling these.
Right. Or as we've suggested so many times, potentially this was somebody like an editor or a publisher, mm-hmm, saying, hey, do you have a sweet little capper that could bring things back? You know, what's a way that we could wrap this up so we don't just end on a story of your choosing? And I'd love to know whether that was the case, or if, yeah, Barker always knew he wanted to begin and end with the same kind of story or something that would speak to itself. But this worked for me, you know, even if we don't remember all of the specific details of that opening story, it's fun to get to this one and say, oh, right, I remember. Okay, we're building to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But also, we've not actually talked about what the story is. So, Brian, what is On Jerusalem Street?
So a hitman, assassin, a gun for hire named Wybird, mm-hmm, is hired to obtain the stories from Simon McNeil, the Book of Blood, for a collector. So basically, he shows up at Simon's front door. Simon, if I remember correctly, kind of knows why he's there, and he's, mm-hmm, cool with it. Like, he has been, you find out that he has been in this state for a while, but those wounds, like, never really fully heal. They always, mm-hmm, look like they're fresh and agitated. Yeah, I think
he's ready.
Yeah, he's ready to go. So, of course, you know, Wybird isn't going to just get away with this scot-free. He puts the skin, I think he, like, puts it into some linen or something like that, and then puts it in a suitcase. And then when he gets to, like, the safe house or wherever he was staying, he opens the suitcase to find out that the blood from the skin has just completely engulfed the bag and is engulfing him.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit vague, but I think he just drowns in the blood, right? It, like, fills up the room, and yeah, he drowns in it. And we pick up with him on the Highway of the Dead that was introduced in the first story in the first Book of Blood. And just on this weird, like, dark but also kind of whimsical note where he's just sharing his story with another one of the dead people going along the highway.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting, not entirely ambiguous, but very, and the stories will continue. Yeah. And there is life after death, and bad things happen to bad people. Like, this is a short one, and yet it encapsulates so much of what many of the other volumes have accomplished.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was just a nice little cherry on top of the books of Blood Sunday. It was a really nice way to kind of just send us off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny. So, Brian, that is volume 6. Do you want to reflect back on all of them and tell me a couple of your favorite stories?
Yeah. I mean, there are ups and downs in this. I think for me, the nadir of the experience, I think, was volume 3. I think at that point, for whatever reason, that was a collection that was just steeped in bleak nihilism.
Right.
It was, I just remember that one being kind of a slog to get through. We talked about during the episode how that part of my just might have been where, like, you and I were in the process. Like, we were, you know, just kind of like neck deep in these stories. We had been reading a bunch of them, and it was just getting a little tiresome by that point. But
right.
I think other than 3, and even 3 had, you know, some bright spots, but for the most part, there was always something to like about every one of these volumes. And yeah, I think, you know, I think we have our top 3s listed. For me, I think I was going by ones that stood out for the way that they kind of really showed what Clive Barker was about in ways that connected with me.
Okay.
So my number 3 was The Skins of the Fathers. This was from volume 2. This was the story about the young boy who is the product of sexual relations between a woman and a demon. And it's kind of the precursor to the kind of thing that Clive Barker really likes to talk about in Cabal and other stories, where it's inverting the idea of what it means to be monstrous and what it means to be, like, villainous.
Right.
Because, you know, we get the podunk town, closed-minded, like, sheriff and townsfolk, and, you know, they launch this attack on these demons who are really just, for the most part, trying to mind their own business.
Right.
And, yeah, it was, I feel like this story is the introduction to that mindset that Barker brings, where, you know, monstrous doesn't have to mean evil.
Right. And it was really visually evocative. Like, yes. I found this one very cinematic, this idea of a parade of different types of quote-unquote monsters making their way through the desert and having this standoff. It does also feel like it's the kind of thing that we will cover in Barker's movies, right? You know, the fact that there's visual imagery that we would see pop up in Lord of Illusions when people get trapped in the mud and then it freezes over and they're just stuck there. Evocative to me.
And so horrifying, the idea of that happening. Yeah. Like, it's bad in Lord of Illusions. I feel like in the story it's even worse because they are trapped in, like, rock in the desert. Like, this is really unforgiving territory. So to get stuck in an environment like that, and, you know, one person, I think it's like just their face coming out of the ground, and you know there's nothing they can do about it. Like, they're gonna die there, and it's gonna take a while. And it's just, it was a horrifying, but in a way, like, not as Clive Barker as some of his other imagery, where it's not like visually gorily grotesque, but it is something that, like, that'll keep you up at night if you think about it.
Yeah. Okay, so I went for visceral and gore and really upsetting. I came down to a tie for my third favorite story. So I'm divided between Rawhead Rex from volume 3, which is the monster that was encased in stone, broken open, and just goes on an absolute killing spree across the small UK town. And also The Age of Desire, which is the aforementioned, we experimented on aggression in a chimp and we then put it into a man who volunteered and he goes on a sexual assault spree.
Yeah.
I can unequivocally say these are not stories for everyone. And I know that that is a bit of a false criticism, because what does it even mean? It's like, well, you maybe have to read them for yourself and decide if you're a fan. But to me, these are so emblematic of Barker's button pushing-y. That is not a term, but it's basically his unwillingness to compromise on art if it makes you uncomfortable. Like, these stories feature some horrendous things, like child murder, sexual assault, like just absolutely awful, awful stuff.
Demonic water sports.
I mean, hey, if you're into that, that is not a bad thing at all.
And actually, of those things, that's probably like the least... like the least affecting of the stuff that's in those stories.
Right. But doesn't it like burn off that pre-space when he does it?
Oh, I think there might be a little melty action going there.
All this to say, these stories were so challenging and confronting. Like, they are disgusting and perverse and upsetting. And I appreciated that they made me feel something, and they seem evocative of a type of stories that we just cannot and will not publish nowadays. So in some ways, they're something of a marvel.
Yeah. No, absolutely. They're both stories that, you know, we talked about, and I was equally uncomfortable, especially with The Age of Desire. But they are stories that, for me at least, can't just be written off as being in bad taste.
Right.
Because they are not shock value for shock value alone. Like, he is having a discussion. I understand if there are some people who have no desire to have that discussion.
Sure.
But yeah, they are compelling because they tread the line between being entirely unpleasant but still having value.
Well, and they're also just too well written. Right? Like, it's really hard to write them off because there's a poetry to the prose that you don't always get in a lot of exploitation, which is just, oh, I'm just going to tell you things to gross you out or make you upset. And here it's like, yeah, you're doing that, but also you're telling it in the most beautiful way possible. Okay, what's your number two pick?
So I really have a soft spot for when Barker decides to get silly. And for me, there is no sillier story than The Body Politic.
Like, I knew a story you would pick this one.
Killer sentient hands. Like, come on. It's also, he also doesn't pull any punches. It is visceral. Some of those descriptions are still pretty hard to watch. And that's, and, you know, there's the obvious stuff because there's a lot of dismemberment. There's a lot of hands like ripping people apart. But then there's also this sense of like when, and I forget what the lead character's name is, but when his hands take over and choke his wife to death, like how horrifying that must be. Like, you're coming out of a dream and you realize you're choking your wife to death. And there's nothing you could do about it. You're not controlling yourself, but you're still doing it. Like, And it, again, Barker is all about combining things that like seemingly shouldn't be combined. So he's taking these really horrific elements and putting them into a story that is like, it's almost a When Animals Attack movie, but it's with sentient body parts. It's just ridiculous. Yeah. And he never does it with a wink. Like, he takes it dead serious. But, like, you also know the premise is just inherently goofy. And so he is willing and confident enough to lean into that premise and not make it, like, jokey. Like, he's not looking for punchlines. He is just letting you go on the ride.
Yeah. This story, when we read it initially, I wrote it off a little bit as too cheeky, too winky. It felt like we had already covered some of this ground with the previous short story, Confessions of a Pornographer's Shroud, from Volume 3. But I feel like this is a better version of that. It's really towing that line between comedy and sensational. But you're right, there's a whole bunch of really horrifying moments in it that help the story to stand out and I think stand on its own as well.
Agreed.
Mine is an upsetting one. So my second pick is Pig Blood Blues from Volume 1. This is the first of several stories that Barker will set in prison. I would argue it's his most successful of them. And this is the one where we are worshiping a pig god and we sacrifice boys to it. And it's a bit of a conspiracy. The feels like it has a mythology that is of its own, And I just found this one incredibly atmospheric and really vividly memorable. It stuck with me for weeks and even months after we read this. It was still like, what's one of my favorite stories from this collection? And it's this one I go back to and my number one.
Yeah, this is one of those ones where for me, it's an issue of, I acknowledge that, like, objectively, this is a really well-written story, but just in terms of, like,
it's just not a you
personal
story.
Taste, it's not my thing. Yeah. And, yeah. And there is that level of just, like, it is so dour.
Yes.
And it is relentless. Like, there is, you mm-hmm. just dwell and fester in this sense that, like, everything is shit.
Everything is shit. It's all dread. It's all awful. There is no escaping it.
There are really no redeeming characters in it. Like, even the main character who's kind of quote unquote the hero might also be a pedophile. Like, it's Barker is just floating in the muck in this one.
Yeah. As this only is he the, can. The pits of humanity, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that takes us up to number one. What was your favorite story of the six volumes?
So the only thing I like better than silly Clive Barker is whimsical Clive Barker. And I think he hits that perfectly in Sex, Death, and Starshine. So this is the one where it's the old theater that is like on the brink of shutting down. And there are like ghosts of previous actors and directors who are kind of pushing into a sequence of events to basically kill the current production and turn them into this roaming undead theater troupe.
Yeah.
I love that. Like, and it's, it brings in, there's a melancholy to it, which I like. So like, I don't like dour, but I love melancholy. There is a bit of humor in it. He also brings in that Clive Barker kind of uncomfortable, but also titillating element. Like the scene where the director gets a blowjob from his undead leading lady. It's I cringe saying it out loud, but there was something.
It's hot and perverse. Hot.
Yeah.
It feels like it's an old EC comic kind of plot line as well.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it brings together a lot of my favorite elements of Clive Barker work. You know, the left of center sexuality, the whimsy, but there's still like a lot of death to it. So it's not just like a completely light romp. You know, it's still Clive Barker, but doesn't leave me feeling like I need to take a shower like I did after Pig Blood Blues.
Yeah, I can see it. I was interested to see where you would come on your last pick, and I feel like I maybe stole the one you would have truly picked if I hadn't picked it because you wanted to spread some of the love out. But seeing that this was your top pick, I wasn't surprised at all. And it's one of the reasons I so enjoyed doing this project with you is because I never would have picked this story. This one was like, it's not a bad story. I don't think any of these are truly bad, but this would have been probably in my bottom half of the stories. But having the conversation with you forced me to appreciate all of the things I wasn't giving the story credit for. And I love that. Like, I love that you found silly, whimsical lightheartedness in this story that I was just, you know, I was prepared to write it off. And I think that's the value of engaging in a dialogue about art, because you're forced to not just explain why you like something or dislike it, but also you gain this appreciation for things you might have missed because other people shine a light on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I love that we do have, you know, for as much overlap as we have on a lot of Clive Barker stuff and our love for Hellraiser and Julia Cotton, like, yeah, there are definitely ways in which we diverge in our taste. And being able to appreciate something like Pig Blood Blues from your perspective, you know, it lets me look at it through a different lens other than just like, man, that was too bleak.
Right. Yes.
And I will say,
let's go back and talk about Dread again, shall we?
No, thanks. Hard pass. But I will say, by way of introduction to your number one, I don't think I would have chosen that as my number one. Oh. I really love the visuals in this. The overall story, I'm okay with. The standout and the thing that we talked about the most is just the mind-bending visuals of this story. Yes.
Literally, I have not read a story that has created such evocative visual imagery in my brain as my number one pick, which is In the Hills, the Cities. Trying to even have a conversation about visualizing this nearly broke us in two, Brian. And you can't say that about everything that you read. Like, we can say, oh, it's cinematic. Oh, I didn't have a difficult time visualizing this or imagining it or whatever. This one was like, how do I wrap my head around what I am reading? And how has Barker done this to me? And for that, I just have to, you know, stand up, take off my hat, and give him all the kudos, because I just don't know how this story works, and I don't know how it works so fucking well.
Yeah, like he almost turns us into the feral, gnashing townspeople that become part of those two. Like, we just, it implodes our brain to the point where it's just like, yeah, the rest of the story leading up to it.
Mm-hmm. The human characters. I'm fine with, who could care?
Yeah, could not give a shit about. But yeah, and I think that's where, like, if there's a place where, if this doesn't make my top three, it's because of that. Mm-hmm. It's because for as compelling as those visuals were and the way it culminates is so effective, the rest of it just kind of left me a little flat.
But, right.
But damned if it's not worth it just for the way he writes something that you can both perfectly picture but not at all understand.
Yeah. Just that, right? I mean, the idea of people, whole towns of people coming together to form giant entities that battle for supremacy, that go as high as the clouds. It just, it doesn't compute. Mm-hmm. And yet, as soon as I say it, everybody can immediately, like, there's something there. There's just something so fascinating about the idea. You know, do we wish that we had characters we care deeply about that were involved in this? Maybe. But at the end of the day, the visuals speak for themselves, which is the stupidest thing I've ever said on mic, because how does a visual speak? But it does. It sings.
Yeah. I am rarely cognizant of descriptive writing. Like, usually my focus is on character and plot and you know, pushing forward the narrative. This was one where it's like, no, this was so visceral and just so perfectly well written. Because, like, I keep wanting to say things like so crystal clear, but it's like, it's not.
It's not.
And it's purposely not. It is in some ways ineffable. Like, what he's describing is bordering on cosmic horror.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Which isn't surprising because, you know, we talked about, you know, that was something that I think Trace brought it up. When we were talking Hellraiser, like, that's cosmic horror. So it's not like he's, Barker is not a stranger to those elements, but it's kind of a weird blend of folk horror and cosmic horror in this story. Yeah.
Which are not things that you would expect to put in connection to one another.
Mm-hmm. That's Barker in a nutshell. Like, I'm going to combine these things that are going to make you uncomfortable for various reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh, so good. Okay. Well, Mr. Brian, our time with Books of Blood, the written version, has come to an end. Mm-hmm. So I think we should talk about the film adaptation, as we are apt to do.
Let's do it. Yeah, I am on board for that. I mean, if nothing else, it's not going to take us nearly as long as reading six volumes of Books of Blood.
No, I should think not. I mean, we should note that the movie is only about an hour and 50 minutes long. But yeah, so folks, when we come back next time, we're going to be talking about the 2020 film adaptation by Brannon Braga. And I've had an opportunity to see this before because Trace and I covered it on the Patreon back in 2020. But I've literally not thought of it a day since we covered it. So I'm interested to see how I feel about it now that I've read all the short stories. I can't even recall if we're adapting specific ones or if we're just taking the framing device and using it as a starting point.
Yeah, I have not seen it myself. I don't know what stories are included. So I think this will be an interesting adventure and a really interesting way to cap. Well, I hope it's interesting way to cap off this book series.
Yeah. Okay. So, folks, that's where we're headed next time. Books of Blood, the movie. But until then, Mr. Brian, if folks want to talk to you about their favorite stories or any of the ones from Volume 6, how would they get in touch?
Please be sure to hit me up on Blue Sky or Instagram at Evil Taylor Hicks.
Nice. And I can be reached at B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B. And of course, we'll thank the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network for hosting the show. All right. Well, until we get to see how a book of blood looks visually on screen, folks, hope you've had a fun time with all these short stories.
Squad.